Hi, thanks for tuning in to season 5 of the Aced It podcast, where we translate science into sense so you can learn about research in the justice and health fields without having to read a lengthy journal article or report. This season, we're trying something new. Interviews. In each episode, you'll hear from top experts working on research within the JCoin network. I'm so excited. It's like you get a glimpse behind the scenes with these fascinating folks as they talk about what they're learning, the struggles they faced in their projects, and what amazing findings they have so far. Findings that will surely make a difference in the lives of so many. It's almost too good to be true. So with that, I'm Danielle Rudes, your host, coming to you from Sam Houston State University in Texas. With ACID, I do most of the work for you. All you have to do is listen. ACID is a cool and super helpful product brought to you by the Center for Advancing Correctional Excellence, ACE, at George Mason University. For more info, check out jcoinctc.org. Now, let's get started. Okay, so welcome to another awesome episode where I get to have an interview. I'm super excited today to be joined by Rosemarie Martin. She is from the JCoin Brown University Hub and her colleague, Linda Hurley, who is one of the community partners on that study. So Rose and Linda, I'm going to let you introduce yourselves, but I want to say a big hearty thank you for being here and welcome.
Hi, my name is Rosemarie Martin, and I'm an associate professor in behavioral and social science at the Brown School of Public Health, and I am a multiple principal investigator for the Brown University JCoin Research Hub.
And I'm Linda Hurley. I'm a co-investigator and community partner for Brown University for this study. I'm also the president and CEO of Kodak Behavioral Healthcare, which is the largest provider of opioid treatment in Rhode Island.
Thank you for those introductions. To get us started, just a general question. What are you going to discuss with us today? Can you tell me about your project, maybe a little bit about your research questions?
Today, we're going to talk to you about the Brown Research Hub and our project. Broadly, when I think about what our research question was and what we plan to tackle and the challenge that we plan to tackle with our project, I think about, in terms of a long-term question, it's how can we improve the capacity of the criminal legal system to effectively respond to the opioid crisis? Broadly, how can the criminal legal system respond to individuals that they provide services for who have opioid use disorder? To answer this broad question, we're using a type 1 hybrid implementation effectiveness trial that consists of two phases. In phase 1, Our research question is, can we use a systems change approach for increasing evidence-based practices for opioid use disorder among those who are under community supervision, so in the supervision setting? Here, we're partnering with community supervision offices on the East Coast and community treatment providers, and we're looking to engage both in a change process that will improve the delivery of evidence-based services for those under community supervision. And for community supervision, we're talking about the criminal legal system correctional program in the community. So most people know this as probation and parole. So that's the setting we're targeting. So we're focusing, and our target of our intervention is the criminal legal system, specifically community corrections. So phase one, we're going to do a systems change approach. In phase two, our question is, if we provide peer support services in addition to referral for medications for opioid use disorder, does it improve the outcomes for these folks that are under community supervision?
That is so interesting, and it sounds critical. Can you tell me what states your project is working in?
So for our project, we are across three states on the East Coast: Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. We're providing interventions for enhancing recovery.
Okay, great. Can you also explain to our listeners why this work is so important? I think I know the answer, but I think the listeners want to hear it from you.
So why this is important is that we know that many people on community supervision who have had opioid use disorder never get the high quality care needed to recover. It's been reported, estimated, that only 2 to 10% of those who need treatment get it. There's a lot of reasons for this, including logistical barriers, lack of access to evidence-based care, and stigma.
And when we look at community supervision specifically, this is a very large population. So in 2020, 1 in 66 adults in this country was supervised in community supervision. That's a lot of people. And an estimated 60 to 80% of those in community supervision have a substance use disorder. We know that following release from incarceration, individuals with opioid use disorder, there's usually a return to opioid use and a substantial increased risk of dying from overdose. We also know from providing evidence-based care and medications for opioid use disorder while individuals are incarcerated that we can decrease overdose death rates statistically significantly. These programs are very effective. And if we're providing evidence-based treatment while people are incarcerated, our community corrections settings must be prepared to provide evidence-based practices and care as well.
Thank you both. I can hear the passion exuding from you as you talk in your voices. I also have to say that I am personally so grateful to you for all the work that you guys are doing to help people. I'm wondering though, given what you're talking about in terms of these partnerships, why did you choose community corrections? What was interesting there?
When we thought about our research question and determining how we were going to impact change on the community supervision and community corrections setting, we realized that community corrections provides a unique opportunity to engage individuals in treatment. It also has unique challenges. Community supervision agencies are not structured for service delivery. They're not service providers. It's public safety, and that is their mission. And probation officers often lack the training and motivation to refer individuals to treatment. And this indicated a need for informed partnerships to supplement current practices for those with opioid use disorder. So we wanted to improve contact, communication, and clarify role expectations between community corrections and community treatment providers. And we believe that this will stand to improve the continuum of care for those with opioid use disorder.
Okay. And how did you go about structuring this project with so many different folks involved?
So we began with a community engaged approach. And we literally sat around the table with all stakeholders that would be involved in reaching our goals with the project. Community corrections personnel, providers, and the researchers, from some researchers from Brown University. It takes a long time, and we learned that it takes a long time in order to have solid system change. We've had a lot of success in the prison and jails here in Rhode Island, and we wanted to continue that success. We've seen, as Rose has said, a decrease in overdose death due to the collaboration and true systems change that occurred in the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. And it only makes sense to follow that through into the community when people are also on probation or parole. So we brought everybody together that would be a stakeholder in this initiative, in this study, and again, with the knowledge that this is going to take time. So we determined, you know, we made it very clear what was going to happen with this research. How could it be applied? Basically, was it worth the community correction staff time to even participate with us? Was it worth the time of community providers, both groups, with far more on most of their plates than 40 hours a week, would it be worth it to invest the time in this? And there was your engagement. And then it's a question of listening. And this is systems change 101. We need to be able to listen, have people know they're heard, and know that even if there's differences, that the differences are being respected. Following through with that, and being very clear about expectations in a respectful way builds relationship. And relationship is clearly what we have done.
Listen, feel heard, and respect differences. I love it. I know our listeners are thinking, wow, so much time invested. And yes, true, but for good reason. What happened next?
So after we met with all of our stakeholders and brainstormed and talked about what the goals and objectives would be, and we obtained the buy-in from our community partners and our criminal legal partners, as a research team, we came back together and developed a plan for engaging with our partners so that we could have evidence-informed but locally defined research goals. And that was through the engagement of local change teams. And our local change teams consist of the probation staff and probation supervisors and our community treatment providers also sit around the table with a facilitator that's provided by the study, who this is what he does, is he facilitates systems change approach. So we call that a coach. So our coach meets with our local change teams. So the local change team in Philadelphia is Philadelphia, born and raised. They are folks who work for Department of Public Safety in Philadelphia and Community Corrections. Our local change team in Rhode Island is Department of Corrections here in Rhode Island. Our local change team in North Carolina are community providers in North Carolina. So again, it's locally defined. So our goals are locally defined. So each department is defining a goal and working towards that goal with the help of a coach who's facilitating and assisting them in this change process. And we have some rules for this. And one of the rules is that they use existing resources. We don't want to be a burden on our departments. We're asking them to invest their sweat equity and enhancing and improving their services for those that have opioid use disorder. The goal is to achieve the change project, whatever that goal is, using currently available staff and materials. So we're not asking for investment beyond that. Secondly, we're teaching them how to measure change. So our local change team has to understand that simple measures are the lifeblood of successful change projects. And to that end, they collect only the information that's needed to achieve the project aim. And the third rule is that we want to see that changes are sustained, and we want to build in processes so that the changes that they make as part of this project are sustained. And for example, in one of our sites, they've added screening for opioid use disorder and substance use disorder more generally. So screening for substance use disorder and referral to treatment is now part of their electronic supervision, which is their workflow and case management system. It's right there, part of it. So that is going to help with the sustainability of the practices that they are implementing and employing. We know that it takes diverse strategies, particularly within the criminal legal system, and we need these so that we can improve the transitions across the systems of care.
Evidence-informed, but locally defined research goals with everyone involved. This is amazing. And the inclusion of a coach, so smart. I bet that has had a tremendous effect on the outcomes for the overall change. And, oh my gosh, I almost forgot, sweat equity. That is fantastic. Rose and Linda, I am loving this collaborative project. My question is, though, collaboration and COVID don't always go hand in hand. How did COVID impact what you were doing?
COVID created systems change, and it was not an organized systems change approach. Everyone uses the word pivot. We did pivoted. And since COVID, we've happily disregarded or stopped many of those changes that we did simply to mitigate transmission. But there's many things that we found were helpful. And those are, you know, the hybridization of being able to teach, being able to actually engage. We've worked hard on having this kind of hybridization fine-tuned. So we have currently with our local change teams, again, I'll use that as an example, they meet face-to-face. But when we have other meetings, we can easily bring people in from across the country, across the world. And that's been very positive, and it keeps the consistency that we need to continually engage and retain actual excitement for all the stakeholders in this. Also, and probably most importantly, is we know that use of opioids has increased. Overdose death due to opioids has increased. Suicidality has increased, particularly among this most vulnerable population in community corrections. So COVID increased need and actually decreased our ability to meet the need. And we shifted what we had to do. You know, the most important thing to do was to get Narcan in all the communities, was to stop the increasing overdose death with the increasing lethality of the product that has been available to folks on the street.
Oh, gosh. So good, but so challenging at the same time regarding COVID. Can I switch just a little bit, because I know I want to get this out there. What, if any, findings do you have so far?
One of the most interesting findings thus far has been what I can say is not only a systems change, but a culture change. And that has been so important. I've been in the field for 35 years, and there have been difficulties across the board with community providers and community correctional staff coordinating care to best meet the needs of those who come to us for that care. Why has that been happening? Why it's been happening is it's difficult on a systems level. There have never been easy communication channels. For the last three decades, it has been difficult for community supervision and community treatment systems to communicate. The referral systems are really complex, and there are regulatory issues around confidentiality and funding issues regarding time for individuals to coordinate, to be supportive of those that are probationers or parolees. And truly, the concerns around privacy have been very real, very real. At an organizational level, there's often a lack of support, primarily due to funding, insufficient funding. People are already spread so thinly that they have caseloads that are, as I said before, aren't possible to even accommodate in a 40-hour week. And the most, I think the biggest critical, most critical issue, and we found this when we were working in a carceral setting as well, is that the missions are different. And we created a system that allowed discussion to understand each other's missions and respect those missions. And eventually, for the project, the mission for the project needs to be an integration of those missions, you know, community safety or rehabilitation and safety. There's an overlap. Safety is key. And at the level of the workforce, staff resistance for this kind of innovation is often, very often, hard to elicit. A lot of lack of knowledge about MOUD on the correctional side, and on the provider side, there's a lack of understanding of what community safety is, and very often a lack of understanding about how research itself can be so important to what we do. So all of those issues have been part of the discussions, and we're really excited to have this true culture change that is coming about. And as I've sat with the local change team and watched the, again, the integration of mission, basically, I think that we really reached a point where we can collaborate as the community providers in providing the best possible care for those that are coming to us for that care.
Change teams and integration of mission. That is so inspiring. Rose and Linda, I am so grateful that you both joined the podcast today. I have really enjoyed hearing about your wonderful and collaborative project, and I hope the listeners also learned a lot about what kind of work goes in behind the scenes on projects like this to make change actually happen. Thank you again.
We want to give thanks to NIDA for their commitment to those who are under the criminal legal system, those who are part of the carceral system. And we want to thank JCoin for their support of our project.
And I would like to thank Dr. Martin for her leadership and her support, and all of our community partners for their enthusiasm and their actual excitement for the project now. So thank you.
That wraps another episode of the ACEDIT podcast. We thank you for listening to ACEDIT, where we translate science into sense. Also, remember, you can find one-page summary overviews written in plain language for all of the research we cover on this podcast on our website, jcoinctc.org. Our conveniently packaged research summaries may help you remember what you heard here, and they will help you translate this research to your staff, friends, students, or colleagues. ACEDIT is part of the NIDA-funded Justice Community Opioid Innovation Network, or JCoin, through the Coordination and Translation Center, CTC, housed at the Center for Advancing Correctional Excellence, ACE, at George Mason University. Tune in again for more science and more sense with ACEDIT.